This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
The Port of Baltimore, one of the nation's busiest, remains partially shut down today. That's more than a week after a cargo ship collided with the Francis Scott Key Bridge.
There's a ship approaching that just lost their steering. So until you get that under control, we got to stop all traffic.
213 dispatch, the whole bridge just fell down. Everybody, the whole bridge just collapsed.
That's audio from the Maryland Transportation Authority police channel around 1 a.m. last Tuesday as the bridge collapsed. Eight construction workers were on the bridge that night making road repairs. Two were rescued, two were found dead, and the remaining victims are presumed dead. All of the workers killed were immigrants from Central and South America. The tragedy at the Key Bridge in Baltimore highlighted a whole world many of us are unfamiliar with, what happens at U.S. ports.
This is not just impacting Maryland. This is impacting the farmer in Kentucky. It's impacting the auto dealer in Ohio. It's impacting the restaurant in Louisiana and in Tennessee. This is impacting the entire country.
After the break, we explore how the bridge collapse in Baltimore will affect the economy locally, nationally, and abroad. I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A Podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. We've got a lot to get into, so stay with us.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, the automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares how Betterment's innovation can help Americans save.
The real innovation for Betterment about a decade ago was taking a set of tools that were used by the ultra wealthy and making them accessible to the average investor. And that includes tax strategies, that includes dollar cost averaging, that includes taking a long-term view and not getting distracted by market volatility. These are all sort of tricks of the trade. And what Betterment did is they basically said, no matter the amount of money you have, it's always good to be invested. It's always good to start early. It's always good to save. And the power of being consistent in your habits is really the path to long-term wealth.
Learn more about automated investing and saving at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed.
Joining us now from Baltimore is Alvin Williams. He's a longshoreman and member of the International Longshoremen's Association. That's the largest union of maritime workers in North America. Alvin, welcome to 1A.
Hi, Ms. Jen. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Alvin, you grew up in Baltimore, and your daily life is tied to this port. What went through your mind last Tuesday when you heard about the bridge collapse?
I thought it was like a deep fake video. I couldn't believe it. It really is something out of a movie. And then as the morning went on, I had work at 1 o'clock that day. Obviously, I didn't because the entire port shut down for that day and for the days following, pretty much. I started getting phone calls around 10 a.m. And that's when it started to kick in, because the first couple hours were more so the shock of the video.
Your grandfather was a longshoreman in Baltimore, and you've been a longshoreman since you were 18.
Yes, ma'am.
What inspired you to do this work?
It's one of the last real outlets to work and make a good living without a threshold for education in this country. Education's not for everybody. I think it's a great route. I was taking that route when my grandfather approached me and showed me how much I could make potentially. And I hadn't declared a major. And I was like, why not? And 12 years later, here I am.
What did your grandfather tell you about what the work would be like and what it would take to be successful as a longshoreman?
He told me that the hot days are hot and the cold days are cold, but eventually all the days end and then you get a paycheck. And, that was simple enough for me to agree to.
So what is a typical workday like for you when the Port of Baltimore is fully operational?
It's kind of like this beautiful symphony of chaos, because there's giant things moving, there's small things moving, there's people on foot. But everybody knows their job, and I think that that's the most important part, because if one person makes one mistake, a thing that kind of is like breathing can turn into a big heap of mess and chaos, and people can get hurt. So while it, from the outside perspective, might look cumbersome and difficult and all these things. It's a learned skill. And to me, it's, you know, it's like being a valet driver or, you know, bagging groceries. It's like, this is what I do every day. So it's there's no danger in it to me, but I do recognize how hard of a job it is.
What tasks take up most of your day when you're at the port?
Probably loading heavy machinery, because some stuff isn't drivable. Some stuff, like we take helicopters, military equipment off of ships. You can't drive a helicopter, so you have to load it onto a giant truck bed, and then you got to drive that truck onto a tight ship. And, you know, so it's a lot of skill driving and maneuvering. And those are, like, that's typically the most technical part of the job, whether it's what I just described or a forklift operator or any of those kind of things. But there's also guys that have to make sure that that stuff is sturdy for the long journey ahead on the ship. So we have to lash them down with these big, heavy chains and use these bars to crank them into the steel. And so it takes a lot of mental to kind of observe the landscape of a ship and know how to operate it. But also it takes a physical toll as well.
What have you been doing since the bridge collapse?
A lot of nothing. We're down to, you know, one day a week if we're grateful. You know, I'm in a union of over 2,000 members. And these jobs that we're down to require maybe at max 100 people. So there's a lot of people who went from shopping for a new car to we're passing around flyers on how to qualify for food stamps, you know, and it's an overnight thing. So just, you know, trying to stay positive, but also staying abreast to minute-to-minute updates about when we can get an ETA about when work will resume.
Well, lawmakers in both chambers of the Maryland legislature are working to pass laws that would provide some relief programs to port workers and businesses affected by the collapse. The bill is called the Maryland Protecting Opportunities and Regional Trade Act, or PORT Act, and lawmakers are hoping to fast-track its passage by the end of the week. The state of Maryland estimates that there are over 15,000 direct jobs generated by the shipping hub. What support would you like to see for longshore workers specifically?
It's difficult because I work with a lot of prideful people. You know, we're people that get up every day. I haven't not had a job since I was 19 years old. So it is very humbling to now be talking about support and relief efforts and all these things. And I'm only 32 years old. So if you're talking about a 60-year-old man who's worked his entire life, I think that, you know, pride goes before the fall. So I think the best way that I can ask for people out there that are listening to support is to make these routes to support easily accessible and readily available to people who don't know how to operate in anonymity. Because, you know, if you don't know how to operate on a computer, you got to go somewhere to get this information. And if you have to go somewhere to get this information, some people might not go because their pride won't let them. So I just want the process to be as easy as possible so people don't go hungry because they don't want to have to stand in the line somewhere or something like that.
What concerns, Alvin, do you have about the impact of the bridge collapse on your livelihood long term?
All the work is being diverted right now. So other ports are taking on our work, which is great. You know, I work for a union and we're part of the ILA union and we're nationwide and all this stuff's great. But I work in Baltimore. And, you know, obviously our concern is if you go to another state, and it's a little turbulent at first, but eventually you figure out a routine and it starts to work fine. What happens when everything's clear and we can get back to work? You know, maybe that work isn't ours anymore. Maybe it's some stuff doesn't come back. So while I am worried about getting back to work, I'm also concerned long term, like you just asked, what does work look like once it's back to functioning? Because nothing's stopping. The pandemic didn't stop us from working. This isn't stopping ships from moving. They're just going somewhere else. And now when we are able to get back to work, what does our port look like?
Well, I imagine as a lifelong Baltimore resident, that may raise some concerns for you about what it means for the city as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. There have been a lot of investments made in our port infrastructure and contracts, whether it be cruise ships, new super ships coming in, the dredging of the port, the canals. There's been a lot of investment made, and investment helps the infrastructure of the city. And, you know, as a person that lives here, I am directly invested in this being the best city it possibly can be. And if you look at pictures of Detroit 80 years ago, it looked amazing. And it doesn't look the same anymore because a major industry was affected. And I just don't want us to be the next Detroit.
I'm curious about what you want people to know about the work of longshoremen in Baltimore? You know, we get packages delivered to our doorsteps all the time, and we may not think a lot about what it took for it to arrive 2 days after we ordered it. What do you want us to know about your work and the work of your colleagues?
Well, as I said, 2020 was a hard time for everybody. And if there's no better year to encapsulate what it's like being a longshoreman, it was that year to me, because no matter what happens in the world, we have to keep going to work, whether it's 0 degrees outside, if it's 107 degrees outside, we're at work making sure that this cyclical operation doesn't lose a cog in the machine. And, you know, it's scary to think that we might not be a part of that machine for a while. But I just want people to know that, you know, people work hard and every day is a little harder, but, you know, we're going to get through this.
That's Alvin Williams. He's a longshoreman in Baltimore and a member of the International Longshoremen's Association Union. Alvin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, what do we know about the crew aboard the cargo ship that collided with the Key Bridge? We get to that and more after a quick break.
This message is brought to you by NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance. You call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. Tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options within your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Amgen, a biotechnology pioneer leading the fight against the world's toughest diseases such as cancer, heart disease, asthma, and osteoporosis. In a new era of human health, Amgen continues to accelerate the pace of change, operating sustainably and drawing upon deep knowledge of science to push beyond what's known today. With each decade, they reliably deliver powerful new therapies to patients. Learn more at Amgen.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
Let's get back into the conversation about what happens at our U.S. harbors. Joining us from Alexandria, Virginia, is retired Rear Admiral Richard Temme. He had a 32-year career in the U.S. Coast Guard and served as Assistant Commandant for Prevention Policy. He's now president of VX Marine, which provides marine assets and services. Admiral, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jen. It's great to join you.
And with us from Baltimore is Hallie Miller. She's a reporter with the Baltimore Banner who's been covering the Key Bridge collapse. Hallie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Hallie, you grew up in Baltimore, and I'm curious what it's been like for you to watch this story unfold.
It's been remarkable, really, and to see the city come and really stand together and stand strong like it has in the days since. I was just at the Orioles game on Monday, and there was a tribute to some of the first responders that night. They were in the governor's box. And I know at opening day, the three Maryland State policemen were honored during the third inning. It just feels like it's everywhere. It's the topic of conversation everywhere you go. Fort McHenry, which is not far from my home in Baltimore, it was packed over the weekend with people standing there looking at the wreckage, phones out, cameras out, some people just sitting there very quietly and staring. It really has just been this huge kind of seismic event here that I don't think we've seen anything like this in the city or in the region for a long time.
What more have we learned about the victims of the bridge collapse?
So two bodies have been recovered so far and four others are missing. We understand that all six of them were Latino immigrants who came to the U.S. to help support their families. A former coworker of theirs who worked that same overnight shift and was actually recently reassigned to another shift told reporters a day after the collapse that these men were humble and hardworking. We know from interviews with their families and those who knew them that they were in their 20s and 30s and 40s. They came to the country from Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. They were working for a county-based company, a construction company called Bronner Builders, and they were repairing potholes the night of the collapse. And we understand that they were maybe waiting in their cars, waiting for the cement to dry, and that may be why two of the bodies so far were found in a truck. Many of them lived in the city or in the surrounding counties. They were part of the growing Latino communities here. And some have even lived here for decades and were very deep in the process of getting full citizenship. Some of them had children in city schools. They were very much a part of the community here.
Admiral Timmy, you've worked on U.S. coasts and harbors for more than a decade. How common are tragedies like this?
Well, Jen, the loss of life certainly distinguishes this casualty. We do see regularly there's disruptions to our waterways from what we shorthand collisions, elisions, and groundings. So when ships go aground, lose power, hit things, go aground, it's a regular occurrence in that we investigate. But to this magnitude, including the loss of life, this is a unique one. I think you have to go back to 1980 with the Sunshine Skyway Bridge collapse when it was hit by a ship to see something similar.
Well, Maryland Governor Wes Moore spoke at a press conference yesterday afternoon, and here's part of what he said.
We cannot rebuild the bridge until we first clear the wreckage. But we will clear the channel, we will move the dolly, and we will rebuild the Francis Scott Key Bridge.
Hallie, how are recovery efforts going? Where do they stand right now?
It is slow moving. It is extremely complicated, tough, tedious work. The mission has shifted from what's known as a rescue and recovery mission to a salvage operation, which essentially means the hopes of recovering the bodies has been stalled until some of the wreckage can be cleared. So that really has to be dealt with first. And it is an enormous undertaking. The biggest crane available on the Eastern Seaboard has been called in. And even though it can carry 1,000 tons, it's still not enough. Everything needs to be sawed down and cut up before it can be lifted by the crane so that you don't overtake the crane and risk it, you know, collapsing. The timeline is very murky at best, but some estimates are, you know, at least a few months. And even after some of the debris gets cleared, you have to then think about the shipping channel and whether that needs to be dredged, whether you need to, whether the depth of the ocean or the river floor needs to be, you know, repaved, essentially. This is extremely complicated, sophisticated work, and the dolly is an enormous ship. The bridge itself is very heavy. These are materials that are all tangled now and mangled. It's not going to be easy, and it's going to be expensive.
And Admiral Timmy, give us an understanding of how Baltimore's port compares to other shipping ports in terms of its size and scale.
The Port of Baltimore, depending on the volumes you look at, whether they're for containers or cars, roll-on, roll-off traffic, measured a little differently. So somewhere in the top 20 ports in the United States across all those cargoes. So it's a large port. It's a significant port to the Eastern Seaboard and to the marine transportation system. There are officially 360 ports across the United States, but the top 25 ports move almost 98% of that cargo. And so this is a significant change to the supply chain. It's a significant change to the vessel traffic on the Eastern Seaboard. And I think it is rightly in the headlines now to show those impacts. My concern is that we tend to undervalue and underserve the waterways in our public policy discussions. In this country, import and export traffic is up to 98% carried by water. If it's leaving or coming, it's coming on a ship. And I don't think the public awareness there is commensurate with the impact it has on our daily lives and our national security.
What are your specific national security concerns around the traffic on our seas now and how it's connected to our commerce?
So as a maritime nation, we're dependent on our seaways for our economy and to project our military to places that protect our interests. And so the ability of the marine transportation system to continue to function and meet our needs is a huge national security priority in what it gives us. My concern here is kind of twofold. One is the vulnerabilities in the system that continue to evolve given the changing nature of maritime. That's cyber. That's the ecosystem itself as we see larger ships, as we see deeper draft ships, as we see volume increase across our ports to meet our import and export needs. We need to be able to change at the port level to address those. And sometimes that's simply deepening a channel to a new depth. It might be increasing the traffic control that we have on those waters. In a more strategic perspective, it's the ability of the United States to compete in the maritime space against those who would change the international system. And so as I look at what U.S. shipping does today, it's about 0.5%. It's about 0.4% of the world's fleet. That's down from over 30% in the 1950s. We've lost the ability to move goods and cargo ourselves as a nation, and we're dependent on other nations to do that. China, they're the largest owner of tonnage on the waters, and they also have the world's number one capability in shipbuilding. Whereas the United States has about 180 ships that fly our flag on the ocean's waters, China has over 5,000.
I want to turn to the Dali. That's the cargo ship that collided into the Key Bridge, causing it to collapse. It's still there. This ship is about as long as the Eiffel Tower is tall, 984 feet. And as of Wednesday, the ship was under about 4,000 tons of the bridge wreckage. Hallie, what do we know about the crew on board the Dali?
We know that they're still there, which is, I mean, it's remarkable if you think about it. Many of them don't have visas. They can't get off the ship. They don't have the ability to get out and roam like you might think that they do. I think the role that the crews play on some of these ships is something that has been undercovered for years. And we know just from our reporting there that they really depend on the donations and support of benevolent organizations to get things that they need. So we know as of this week they have hotspots, they have a Wi-Fi connection, they have some homemade goods, but they have not been able to leave the ship. And that's true of some of these other ships that are still docked, you know, at the port. I think in all it's about 150 crew members.
Well, Reverend Joshua Messick is Executive Director of the International Seafarer Center in Baltimore, and that's one of several nonprofit groups delivering packages to the stranded workers on the Dali. And here he is speaking earlier this week in an interview with the show As It Happens from CBC Radio.
The crew has been very cautious about their communication with the outside world. They have my contact information, and so I'm in touch with them via WhatsApp. I can tell you that they have all the supplies they need, all the food. They are all safe and healthy. They're just waiting to see what's next for them.
So Hallie, how long is that ship and other ships that are being held right now? How long are they expected to be there?
I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. I mean, it depends on things like the weather. We've had a couple really rainy days here, and that has interfered with the cleanup effort. So that takes time. It depends on the current and the flow of the water. If it's rough out there, then, you know, it becomes unsafe for crews to get out there and do some of the cleanup work. It depends on things like equipment. So we obviously have the largest crane available on the eastern seaboard, but that's not going to be enough, quite frankly, to do this quickly. So maybe they'll get more equipment, but all of that will contribute to the timeline.
Let's pause here. Still to come, cargo ships have been growing in size since the 1980s. What does it take to get a ship the size of several football fields into port? We'll be right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Integrative Therapeutics, with vitamins and supplements previously available only through practitioners, including Cortisol Manager. Unlock your best self with clinician-curated supplements from Integrative Therapeutics, now on Amazon.
Let's get back to the conversation with this message from Gordon.
I can't understand operating such an important port here in the United States without having pilot tugboat services there to escort these behemoth-sized container vessels, okay? Many other ports in the world will not allow any large ship over a certain tonnage to pull away from a pier or a loading dock without having two pilot tugs standing by.
Gordon in Florida, thanks for that message. Admiral Timmy, to Gordon's question, what do we know about who was available to guide the ship out of the port of Baltimore?
From what I understand, there was a tug assist as the ship left the berth. And that's pretty typical across our ports, where underway, immediately docking and undocking, it's assisted by pilot tugs. I think what the caller was referencing more had to do with the escort in and out of port. There are a few places across our nation where we require tugs, in particular the Exxon Valdez in Prince William Sound. There's now a requirement for tug escorts. And those are one of the mitigators that are in place to ensure the safety of the transit. And there are other mitigators that are put into place depending on the characteristics of the port. There's a saying in our business, if you've seen one port, you've seen one port. They're all so different. You cannot extrapolate the operating characteristics of the Port of Houston and apply it to the Port of Baltimore. The channel depths, the widths, the winds, the competing traffic all make a difference. And so each port has the opportunity to put into place the mitigators that they see will best serve the safety and security interests of that port. So in this instance, there was no tug escort.
Now, I want to talk about harbor pilots for a moment. These are some of the highest paid municipal employees. It's also an incredibly dangerous job. Admiral, what do harbor pilots do?
So harbor pilots are tasked with guiding ships in and out of port safely. Global commerce means that ships come from around the world into a port they may or may not have been into before. And the captain of that ship is tasked with the safety of the ship. But as it enters the port, across almost every port in the world, you're required to take a pilot who has an intimate knowledge of the local operating characteristics. Again, if you've seen one port, you've seen one port. The winds, the waves, the currents, the cross traffic, the nuances have to be learned over decades of experience. And so we have pilots in each of our ports that are responsible to do that. And it is a job with a long history. It actually predates the formation. Pilotage in the United States predates the formation of the United States. The colonies had pilots that were required, but to be used by ships entering port for the safety of the cargo and the port.
We also got this email from Jay who says, how much are cargo ships like the Dali and their crew being pushed in our economy? Is there less time and effort being put toward inspections in order to move more products? Admiral, what can you tell us?
Yeah, that's a great question. First, are our seafarers and our mariners being pushed? This kind of echoes the concerns you had for the folks who are stuck on board. Mariners across the globe work incredibly hard. They serve for long periods at sea. They do not often get shore leave, the ability to go ashore, because a ship may turn around in 12 hours, and the crew is required to be part of that turnaround. So no opportunity in a port call to get out. During the COVID pandemic, it was incredibly hard to move crews around the world for relief, and so they ended up on there for much longer than they expected. So that's always a concern for our seafarers. To the point about examination and inspection, each country is responsible. If the ship flies the flag of that country, the country is responsible for inspecting and attesting to the sufficiency of both the crew and the ship's condition. When ships come to the United States It's our policy to board every foreign vessel arriving in the United States at least one time in the year that year. So a ship may call five or six times. We're going to get to it at least once to examine the competency of the crew and the condition of the vessel. That program has come tremendously far in 30 years and really succeeded in increasing the level of quality of the ships that we see here calling up ports in the United States. We see upwards of 80,000 individual calls each year by about 10,000 specific ships in any one year. And so the Coast Guard can do about 8,000 or 9,000 inspections or examinations of those ships under the program called Port State Control.
Well, when we look at cargo ships in the U.S., they keep getting bigger. The Dolly weighs more than 100,000 tons, and it can transport thousands of containers of cargo. Now, the largest container ships in the world can hold twice what the Dolly can. Admiral, how have you seen cargo ships grow in size over the decades you were with the Coast Guard?
I started as a Coast Guard Marine Inspector in the mid-90s. And so I think to the point that Hallie made earlier, if you've never been on a ship of this size, if you've never been up close to a ship this size, it's an enormous, enormous structure. And so in the 90s, I would go onto a vessel under the Port State Control Program, walk the decks, and have the ability in a few hours with a team of inspectors to cover that ship. But even at that time, large crude carriers were near 1,000 feet. What's changed over these 30 years or so that I was doing the job was the container ship size and the cruise ship size. Unbelievable growth in what can go onto one container ship and how deep our waterways now need to be. The channel in Houston is 50 feet. In New Orleans, 50 feet. That's an enormous draft to accommodate that. And so I've seen the big changes in the size of the container ships and the size of cruise ships carrying so many more people out there.
Hallie, you reported on the condition of the bridge before it collapsed. What condition was the bridge in?
So it was given on its latest inspection a rating of fair. So this is kind of right in the middle in terms of bridge condition. So it's a step above poor condition and a step below good condition. So we can say it was neither in poor condition or good condition, but it was sort of right there in that middle sweet spot. We want more details related to the latest inspection. We saw a summary, which is not as good as seeing the detailed inspection. So that's something we're still hoping to get. But we can at least, we know from that summary report that it was required to be inspected every 2 years, which maybe tells us that it wasn't at the top of the radar for the Maryland Transportation Authority, which is the agency responsible for the bridge. Otherwise, it probably would have needed to be inspected once a year.
And do you see this sparking conversations about infrastructure in Baltimore and more broadly?
Oh, it already has. And a colleague of mine had a terrific story today about the Chesapeake Bay Bridge, which was designed in a similar way as the Key Bridge, meaning it's fracture critical, which is something we learned after the collapse of the Key Bridge. If one support column failed, then the entire thing collapsed within seconds. It's just not designed in a way to support the entire structure, if one part of it fails. There's something called redundancy, which, it is an engineering term, which means it was not built to sustain a collision of this magnitude. There was the rest of the columns could not support the bridge once one column gave way. The Chesapeake Bay Bridge, which people already fear driving over, and I have a colleague who's paid someone $40 to drive her over. It's built in the exact same way. It's not built to sustain a collision like this.
Hallie, President Biden visits Baltimore on Friday. What do we know about his visit?
We know that the Biden administration looks very closely at Baltimore all the time for multiple reasons, but in a lot of ways, Baltimore has kind of become central to the Biden administration's infrastructure agenda. The president has pledged to foot the bill for the Key Bridge rebuild. So we expect that to be a focus on Friday.
That's Hallie Miller. She's a reporter with the Baltimore Banner who's been covering the Key Bridge collapse. Also with us today, retired Rear Admiral Richard Temme. He had a 32-year career in the U.S. Coast Guard and served as Assistant Commandant for Prevention Policy. He's now president of VX Marine, which provides marine assets and services. Admiral Temme, Hallie, thanks for speaking with us. Today's producer was Anna Casey. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk more soon. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.